Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. That is one of the signature sounds of the composer Richard Wagner. It's the battle hymn of the mythical winged warrior sisters, the Valkyries. And we know that it is something more than music. But what? It's a clue to what Alex Ross of the New Yorker magazine calls Wagnerism, meaning the bizarre visions and irresistible influence, the spell that one musical genius cast on the world, maybe forever. Wagner's musical mega-shows in the 1860s were a far cry from the old Mozart and Verdi operas. His were longer, deeper, spellbinding fantasies of forbidden love and longing, wounded gods out of a jumble of world religions, German romanticism and ethno-nationalism all mixed up, naked river maidens in the Rhine, and swooning beauty facing death in Tristan and Isolde, which opens like this. This was Alex Ross's point of entry into Wagner and Wagnerism.
Certainly Tristan and Isolde, Wagner's great romantic opera, was the first work of his that really pulled me in. This is a work that has an incredible sensual power to it. The music was very radical for its period, remains rather radical today. It's a music that sort of sends you into a semi-unconscious state. And this was the effect that it had on people of the late 19th century. It was dangerous. It was erotic. It was sort of this dream state opera. It was the eruption of the unconscious. I grew up with classical music. I was just completely absorbed in the main classical tradition, basically from Bach to Brahms when I was a kid. And through my teenage years, I didn't listen to any other kind of music. And I was playing the piano and trying to compose. But the basic idea is that Wagner, I just didn't make any sense to me for a long time. I remember long playing records of Lohengrin and putting them on for a few minutes and just feeling baffled and a little sick to my stomach. It was this music that kind of dribbled from one chord to another. It lacked kind of clear demarcation. And then by my college years, I was getting very interested in the fin de siècle, the turn of the last century, this amazing, decadent, often rather unsettling and chilling period of cultural and political history from, you know, the end of the 19th century into the early 20th. I've just always been absolutely fascinated by this period in literature, in the visual arts. And Wagner was just there lurking behind everything. I began to appreciate the works themselves more and more as theater, as drama, but always with this question mark.
It's funny, when you ask people about their Wagner moment, the Boston conductor, Ben Zander, who had a big Wagner swoon most of a decade ago, he said to me this summer, "I'm not taking that drug anymore, Chris." And then Matt O'Coin, the young opera composer, said he was never addicted to Wagner, but he drops into the Wagner opium den now and then and enjoys it. People do compare it to drugs.
Yeah, this was from the beginning. Nietzsche compared it to a drug. Baudelaire compared it to a drug. I feel that. I think there's actually Wagner had that capacity. He knew he had that capacity. And I think he does deliberately drug his audience at times. But then he also breaks the spell. I mean, I think he was a great theater thinker who could, almost in the manner of Brecht's alienation effect, sort of put you under the spell and then snaps you out of it. One of the really shocking moments in all of Wagner comes after this enormous, endless love duet in Act Two of the opera. And the lovers are discovered, and King Mark and his men enter. And this spurt of violence, very brief moment of action in an otherwise very blissed out, slow-moving piece. And that's shocking because he's put you into this dream world and then he shatters it. And so, yes, he has that power to put you under the spell, but he manipulates it for dramatic purposes. And he's just what you always come back to with Wagner. He's not just a composer. He is a theater thinker. He wrote the text for his operas. He wrote the music. He pretty much designed the theater at Bayreuth. But there's been this whole other effect that he's had outside of the opera house. And that's really what my book is about.
The news of your remarkable book, Alex, 750 pages, and I've read them all, is the influence of this man beyond his music, in his time, also in ours. George Eliot of Middlemarch wanted her novels to roll out like a Wagnerian experience. Proust was a fan. James Joyce, writing his Ulysses, felt himself both fan and rival. The playwright George Bernard Shaw wrote the perfect Wagnerite and was one. Virginia Woolf, W.E.B. Du Bois of The Souls of Black Folk, add Teddy Roosevelt, embodying a certain expansive turn in America. What is the thread here? What are the links?
Well, that's the great question. This is why I wanted to write the book. It's something that hadn't really happened in musical history before, and I don't think it's happened since. You know, Wagner was a very important composer in terms of his influence on music. I don't know if he was more significant than Monteverdi or Bach or Beethoven, probably a little less so. But something happened outside of music, where in the late 19th century, Wagner seemed to be the herald for a new kind of art, a new kind of myth, new forms of identity, new forms of self-expression, a kind of liberation. Hmm. And then there was also this darker side to Wagner, this Wagner as a herald of this dangerous new form of nationalism and racism in Germany. He's powerful, but at the same time, he doesn't actually force a kind of one single experience on the listener.
Alex, what did Nietzsche mean, his sometime friend, when he said, Wagner sums up modernity. It cannot be helped. One must first become a Wagnerian.
So when Nietzsche talks about Wagner as the epitome of modernity, he's saying this is a force that's absolutely of our time that we have to contend with. He saw Wagner very much as a decadent kind of figure. Hmm. And this was a decadence that he himself had to overcome in order to achieve his own voice. But you can understand that quotation in a much bigger sense, maybe in a way that Nietzsche never intended. Wagner as a bridge to modernism, to the radical styles of the early 20th century, to abstraction, to the stream of consciousness.
Stick with Nietzsche for a moment. That alliance of Wagner and Nietzsche, what it lasted. I mean, it looked curious from the start, and then it looks uglier post-Nazism and the Holocaust. You write, what Wagner disliked in Nietzsche, the pitilessness, the exaltation of power, and what Nietzsche disliked in Wagner, the Teutonic chauvinism, the anti-Semitism, it added up to an approximation of the fascist mentality. Nietzsche had had a foreboding. He wrote, "One day my name will be linked to the memory of something monstrous, to a crisis like none there has been on Earth."
Yeah, well, that's a fantastic quote. And, you know, the one thing that everyone knows about Wagner today is that he was Hitler's favorite composer, that he was somehow a herald of Nazism. And that is true, but it's not the whole truth about Wagner. And so this was really one driving reason behind this book. I want to acknowledge that very dark story of how Wagner leads into Nazism. I certainly don't want to deny it or come up with some kind of apologia to avoid it. But at the same time, we can go overboard with this focus on Wagner and the Nazis. A distortion can take place, and we can end up ignoring all those aspects of Wagner that do not fit this picture at all in terms of Wagner's philosophy of compassion, his very interesting, complicated sexual identity, which proved inspirational to early gay rights activists as well as to feminists. There was the sense that Wagner was gay-friendly, to use the contemporary phrase, that the festival at Bayreuth was a place where gay men and lesbians could feel comfortable and express themselves more easily. And so, you know, this is a very interesting strand that sort of plays against this stereotype of Wagner as this nationalist, masculine figure. And this was actually a side of Wagner that caused trouble during the Nazi period. Wagner didn't quite fit into the sort of Nazi archetype of masculinity and heroism as much as Hitler perhaps would have wanted.
Alex Ross of The New Yorker is expounding Wagnerism for us. Coming up, the American Wagner in Teddy Roosevelt, on the frontier, all the way to Hollywood. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Alex, you write interestingly about sort of export Wagner. You say each country saw Wagner through a self-fashioned prism. For the French, he was a torchbearer of the modern. For the British, he was in tune with the legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. In the U.S., Wagner harmonized with a traditional love of wilderness sagas, frontier lore, Native American tales, stories of desperados looking for gold. The high time of the frontier, that is, when coarseness and strength combined with acuteness and inquisitiveness to describe a certain American prototype. Henry Adams wrote that New York knew better than Bavaria what Wagner meant. This was the Wagner that resonated with Teddy Roosevelt's idea of a sort of rough and ready masculinity, and with Teddy Roosevelt's imperial itch also, and his own comfortable connection with doctrines of racial superiority. What's to say about the American Wagner?
So when you get into America in the late 19th century, beginning of the 20th, you're in a very different world. It's almost sort of getting toward this comic book kind of idea of Wagner, these heroes running around in the forest, these sort of strapping young men playing with swords and the buxom female riding on her horse. And so Wagner becomes a prototype of the man with no name, the Western hero. And the direct link there is Owen Wister, the author of The Virginian, right, who was Teddy Roosevelt's roommate at Harvard, and the two were very close friends. Wister was also a composer, and he went to Bayreuth in 1882 when he was still very young to hear the premiere of Parsifal. He didn't get to meet Wagner, but he met Franz Liszt. And then he went out west. He was sort of sent out west to toughen up, as a lot of maybe slightly effete, elite young men were. And on his way out, he was looking at the Western landscape, and he was seeing cowboys, you know, leaning against the sides of railway stations and all this kind of thing. And he saw it through a Wagner lens. So his diary, he keeps mentioning Die Walküre and these sort of lone figures against rocky crags. And then when he writes The Virginian, the breakthrough Western novel, he doesn't name Wagner, but you can see particularly the character of Lohengrin behind the figure of the Virginian, who's never named. And the whole plot of Lohengrin turns on the fact that you can never ask Lohengrin's name. And if you do, he goes away. He can't stay. I think Wister was playing on that. And of course, from The Virginian, you get to the man with no name, Clint Eastwood. You also get to, you know, Batman and Superman. And it was actually the philosopher Slavoj Žižek pointed this out. You know, whenever one of these superheroes gets into a relationship, if the girlfriend asks too many questions, they have to break it off. And this is also the plot of Lohengrin. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether there's a direct influence. It doesn't matter if a particular Batman or Superman comic book writer knows Wagner, although some of them certainly did. The point is, Wagner puts these archetypes, these patterns into the air, and they start spreading. Mm. And so I just love following these links that take you deep into American popular culture. And you can sort of find, once again, Wagner lurking there in the background.
Mm. What did the immortal W.E.B. Du Bois of The Souls of Black Folk, of The Color Line, of Double Consciousness, and all that important black thinking early in the 20th century, what did he mean when he said, the music dramas of Wagner tell of human life as he lived it, and no human being, white or black, can afford not to know them, if he would know life?
Wagner is notorious as the sort of amateur philosopher of race, the popularizer of the racial philosophy of Gobineau, the ferocious anti-Semite, of course, and yet he becomes the favorite composer of the great architect of the American civil rights movement of the early 20th century, W.E.B. Du Bois. What is going on here? For Du Bois, Wagner is a representative figure who modernizes myth, who creates these heroic archetypes, and then black artists can model themselves on Wagner in creating their own heroes rooted in African myth, in black traditions. And so it's a transference. And this happens a lot, actually. It also happens in Ireland with Irish mythology and Irish nationalism patterning itself on Wagner and many other cases. But Du Bois simply loved Wagner's music, and he found it inspirational. This extraordinary story of the coming of John, the one fictional story in The Souls of Black Folk, is about a young black man who goes to a concert in New York, and he hears the prelude to Lohengrin, and he's transported into this different world, and he feels a sense of power and possibility. This also happened a lot with young people at the turn of the last century. Wagner kind of opening up ideas of possibility and future achievement in their minds. But then there's this horribly ironic moment where in the middle of this reverie, the manager of the concert hall taps him on the shoulder and asks him to leave. And it turns out that the white couple sitting next to him is uncomfortable with his presence. And so American racism breaks into and destroys this dream of future greatness, which is being experienced by a young black man listening to Wagner. So it's very interesting. It's very complicated. It's never absolute, I think, in terms of Bayreuth and Wagner as this purely racist phenomenon. This story tells you that there are contrary understandings possible. Du Bois tells you that even more strongly because of the depth of his involvement in Wagner.
Alex Rouse, the range of people touched profoundly by Wagner is just incredible, including George Lucas of Star Wars, D.W. Griffiths, who used his music, Isabella Stewart Gardner, the collector and art patron in Boston. I still haven't figured that out. I wish you'd take just a few, though, and spell out what was going on, starting maybe with George Eliot of Middlemarch and Daniel Deronda.
She was not a fanatic. She was never a fanatic admirer of Wagner. She was interested, but she really admired the sprawl of Wagner. And I think if there is an influence, and she never quite admitted as much, but it's been speculated about in terms of the sheer expanse of novels like Middlemarch and Daniel Deronda, this urge to try to encompass a whole world. And then interestingly, when those novels came out, readers compared them to Wagner. One critic said, speaking about Wagner, after seeing The Ring Cycle, said that Wagner was the George Eliot of music. So Wagner was looked at through the lens of George Eliot.
Speak as you write about Virginia Woolf, the very definition of modernism, but a Wagnerian, we find out.
Yeah, she had her Wagnerian periods. She was quite ambivalent, and sometimes she would sound wildly enthusiastic, and sometimes she'd sound
about what, though,
quite
in particular?
Dismissive. Yeah, well, she just periodically, she'd be talking about the operas in her diaries or in the letters, and she'd say, oh, it just goes on and on and on. I'm just kind of sick of it. And yet, I think Wagner did have an important effect on Wolf. I think Wagner's endless melody, this texture that goes on and on, this pointed toward the stream of consciousness, toward the interior monologue, which is obviously such an important part of Virginia Woolf's mature work. And then her first novel, Voyage Out, is very explicitly about a young woman who is in love with Wagner and kind of coming to terms with that influence. And there's Wagner references all through the book. This happens a lot. I think one interesting pattern that I uncovered is that these big modernist figures, E.M. Forster, D.H. Lawrence, Joyce, Virginia Woolf, their first or second novel, the sort of immature or transitional novel, is the one where the Wagner influence is most conspicuous. Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, D.H. Lawrence's The Trespasser, E.M. Forster's The Longest Journey, Wolfe's The Voyage Out. The Wagnerism is unmistakable and explicit. Then it kind of disappears. It's as if, you know, this is absorbed into the DNA of the author and it no longer needs to be on the surface. It's been, what's the word? It's just been kind of, it's been digested into the nervous system of the authors, and there's no longer this need to make it obvious and specific. And also, you know, in terms of that sense of rivalry, as the artist matures, you have to subdue this influence of the past. And obviously we're getting into the territory of Harold Bloom's theory of the anxiety of influence. Hey. And the relationship between these great modernist authors and Wagner is just one splendid example after another of the anxiety of influence and how it works itself out.
Yeah, that's part of the legend of Joyce and Proust, who admired each other but kept their distance. I want you to talk about Joyce in particular with respect to Wagner. Joyce knew everything, but he quotes Wagner. He refers to Wagner in ways that I had never noticed before I read your book. What was going on there? And particularly, you write fascinatingly about Joyce making Leopold Bloom, his Jewish wanderer in Dublin, at the very center of Ulysses. What was that about? What was he saying back and forth in a kind of blind conversation with the memory of Wagner?
I think it works on a couple different levels. There is just what's going on with these characters and their conscious lives, especially Stephen Dedalus, the young man in Portrait of the Artist and then in Ulysses. The climax, one of the major climaxes of Ulysses in the drunken body Circe chapter set in the brothel is when Stephen leaps up and smashes the chandelier with his walking stick, shouting, "Notung!" Notung is Siegfried's sword in the ring. And so that's Wagner in the daily world of the characters being talked about, being debated. But then there's the mythic dimension of Ulysses, and the sense that behind every character in the situation in Ulysses, there are these mythic models. And Wagner supplies...
In the Odyssey specifically, right?
Yeah, but also I think there are figures like the Flying Dutchman. Leopold Bloom is this, to many people's eyes, alien Jewish man wandering around Dublin. He's compared explicitly to the Flying Dutchman, the eternal wanderer of the seas, whom Wagner himself also connected to the myth of the wandering Jew. And one really extraordinary moment, and I didn't discover this, a Joyce scholar, Timothy Martin, pointed it out, is that in one of his essays, Wagner explicitly says that the Flying Dutchman is a composite of Odysseus and the Wandering Jew. And that, you know, that's Ulysses, that's Leopold Bloom. And it's not a coincidence, because we know Joyce read these essays, and you can actually see him reading. You can see marks in the margins of these essays in his copies of them. So that almost certainly was something that Joyce read when he was a young man. And it may have been, can't be certain about this, but it could have been the very seed of the idea of Ulysses itself. So, you know, the classic formulation is that what happens in Wagner is... the stories are set in the realm of myth, but you can feel all of this modernity behind them. You can feel the bourgeoisie and the revolution and modern psychological themes behind the facade of myth. Joyce, it's completely the opposite. You're in the contemporary realm, but the myth is lurking behind each of the characters.
Willa Cather, a novelist that keeps growing as almost a cult writer now, she wrote a wonderful story set in Boston Symphony Hall that I read years ago about a Wagner concert. Tell us how she became a Wagnerian, this child of the prairies, marvelous writer.
I've gained over the years a deeper and deeper love of Cather's work. And I think her connection to music was what led me in. Very few writers have addressed music and musicians so in such a sophisticated way. And so that was what really attracted me to her work. She was born in Virginia, and then she spent a lot of her childhood on the prairie. It seems as though she read about Wagner before she ever heard the music. And so she would sort of come across these accounts of this German composer who's writing about myth and fantasy and creating these heroic characters. And it appealed to her strongly in this isolation, in this cultural isolation. Again, it's that dream of future greatness that we find so often in stories of young people encountering Wagner. And yet at the same time, you know, she's interested in Wagnerism as a social phenomenon. You know, what goes on with people in her day who are enraptured by Wagner? What's going on in their minds? What kind of effect is it having on them? What does it mean? And this extraordinary early story, A Wagner Matinee, is about a young music teacher who marries a young man. They meet in Boston, and then she goes west, and she goes to the prairie. And 30 years pass, and she hasn't come back. And then she comes east again, and her nephew takes her to this concert. And it's as if she comes alive. It's as if she awakens. So she seems to be this worn-down character who's been living off in what Cather characterizes as this wasteland. People didn't appreciate this in Nebraska at the time, but that's how she's portrayed. And so she experiences one Wagner piece after another. All these memories come back, all these feelings and associations, this sense of a lost life coming back into focus.
Mm.
And it's a fascinating story because a lot of this is being filtered through the nephew, Clark, who has a rather limited idea of what's going on in this woman. There's a lot that he can't see. Maybe he doesn't really understand her at all. So it's his imagining of what's going on inside of her, but there's some other world which is just not being communicated. And I think what Cather is doing here is showing how Wagner acted in the lives, especially of women who were so constricted by the culture of the time in terms of how they could express themselves, how they could talk, how they could behave. And not just in Cather's work, but in a number of other works by female writers of this period, Wagner becomes this private, secret space of self-expression and of imagination that no one else can touch. And especially Wagner's heroic female characters, Brunhilde and Isolde, they became templates for another form of femininity, female expression. It's complicated because Wagner's attitudes toward women himself were hardly feminist, and he can be characterized as a misogynist in a lot of ways, and it's been debated what these characters really mean. But there's just this very, very clear evidence that for certain women of the fin de siècle, Wagner was a window into an unimagined new world. Wagner was a means of liberation, and that wonderful Cather story is one of the best examples of that. Mm.
Coming up, the spooky soundtrack of Empire and Conquest in Wagner, still echoing. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Ludden. This is Open Source. Alex Ross, you speak as you write with lots of ambivalence about Wagner. The good, the bad, the indifferent. But I don't know that we've heard yet what it's all about. I grew up, and you did to some degree, in a sort of Wagner eclipse. After World War II, he was verboten. And he was not in the canon for a long, long time. He's come back. And the modern line has been a version of the thought that Wagner was a perfectly beastly genius, a man of disgusting personal behavior, raging anti-Semitism, poisonous politics, who wrote completely enchanting music. Susan Sontag said, for example, that she acknowledged the proto-Nazi bulkishness in Wagner, but she insists also that the music is about sex, eroticism, voluptuousness, and that's why one goes on loving Wagner. Susan Sontag. I wonder, does that reasoning makes sense, all the more because the man's influence and the bad side lives on and on.
You know, I think it all lives on together. I'm actually not too comfortable with this formulation that splits the man himself from the music. So I actually don't think at all of Wagner as being this utterly horrible man who wrote this utterly wonderful music. He wasn't an absolute monster. He was kind of a trickster in some ways. He was just very, very hard to pin down and just constantly contradicted himself. On the other hand, the music, yes, it's often sublimely beautiful. It is also troubling on all kinds of levels. You know, I personally love the music very much, most of it. I have trouble with Die Meistersinger, the most nationalist, the most ultra-German of the operas. But, you know, I'm totally understanding of those who feel, as I once felt when I was a kid, that the music itself is unappealing and there's something a little sick about it. And so it's just, you know, I just don't split him down the middle in that way. There's ambiguity everywhere. And yet, something about this man, it just, he never recedes into the past. He doesn't go away. He keeps getting wrapped up in whatever is going on in any particular period of history. You know, in Hollywood, he gets swept up in Hollywood myth-making and is quite influential on the development of the movies. You know, in contemporary politics, you see some alt-right, horrible neo-Nazi people using Wagner as a weapon, and it just never goes away. And this is what's so extraordinary about the Wagner case. He just doesn't disappear into history. He remains a live wire. He remains a kind of third rail in contemporary culture. He's unofficially banned in Israel. He's a flashpoint. He's a lightning rod. For the cultural historian, for someone like me, this makes him an irresistible subject because of the continuities from the past into the present.
I wonder, I mean, to my mind, his politicizing of music and art is almost unforgivable. He trashed Brahms over and over again, as if the man had never written a good note, much less piece. He was so egomaniacally devoted to monopolizing the art of the future. That's not a happy man. And it reminds you of a president who can't, there's never been a good trade deal ever. That was the worst one of all time, and those idiots signed it. I mean, that's the voice of, of Wagner. But I'm just wondering, what more do you need to say about an artist whose trademarks, I mean, the center of his work, including extremes of imperial nationalism and hatred, have embedded themselves in public culture and private souls, I think.
Yeah, that's a valid comparison to make, and sure, I think there is something Trumpian about Wagner's obnoxious repetitiveness, his name-calling, his polemics. Of course, I find redeeming characteristics to Wagner's personality that are entirely absent from Trump's. Trump doesn't like Wagner, by the way. We've learned that from Tina Brown's diaries. But I think the mitigating factor here is the breadth of Wagner's political influence. You know, yes, he was such an important example for German extreme nationalism and anti-Semitism, but he was also an enormous influence on the left in a very, very different, very contradictory way. Well into the 20th century, Wagner was still considered a figurehead of the left as a progressive, even as a Democrat. And you find that influence in Bolshevik Russia, where Wagner is being prized as a hero of proletarian culture after 1917. And, you know, this is also a valid interpretation of Wagner. So I think we can't let Wagner be captured completely by the right wing. I think it's actually gives too much credit to Hitler. It gives Hitler a kind of posthumous victory to let him have sole possession of this composer who had so many contradictory elements. He hated militarism, actually, toward the end of his life. He was never a fan of the organized state in any form. There was something very anti-totalitarian about his political thinking. It ignores, it kind of erases this leftist influence, his influence on feminists, on early gay rights activists, on African Americans. So I'm really concerned to fight back against kind of Hitler's posthumous victory of always owning Wagner in perpetuity, because there was just a great deal more to the man than that.
Well, I wasn't thinking of Wagner being captured by the right wing as much as the right wing being captured by Wagner. And we come back to the Ride of the Valkyries. I didn't know until I read it in your book that American troops played it, I'm sure at the ultimate volume, as they invaded Fallujah in Iraq in 2004. The power of that music is embedded in our culture, and it's not pretty. You say in the book that Ride of the Valkyries became an anthem of American supremacy, German will to power, giving way to God bless America imperialism. I mean, there's something irredeemably, inseparably ugly about that spirit.
But it's America that made that music mean those things. This was a deliberate, I think, distortion of what this music is about when Hollywood filmmakers began using it. You know, what gets completely lost is that this is music of the Valkyries. It is the music of powerful women. It is the music of Brunhilde, the character who really ultimately emerges as the hero of the ring cycle, who brings down the power of the gods. She restores the ring to the Rhine. She opens the space for a new, more equal, more hopeful world.
Thank you.
you know, people always forget that for all its powerful driving musical moments, The Ring is ultimately an attack on power. It's a critique of power. This is something that gets completely lost when you play The Ride of the Valkyries accompanying helicopters laying waste to a Vietnamese village. And I think Francis Coppola, when he used that music in Apocalypse Now, he was illustrating how America becomes imperialist by using The Ride of the Valkyries. He reminds you of the Nazi past, and he essentially is saying, in so many words, American troops are now perpetrating this kind of aggression in the way that German troops did in the past. It's an uncomfortable comparison for American viewers to confront. It doesn't have much to do with Wagner.
It's a cue in any event to listen up carefully. This is a signal. Something heavy is going down here. Why didn't he come to America? And what if he had, as his great conductor Mahler did eventually? What if he'd become an American, as Schoenberg did?
Well, that's a fantastic kind of fantasy to have, because he did contemplate coming to America, especially in the late 1870s. He didn't like this new imperial German state. And so he fantasized about coming to America, and he came up with actually a proposal that Wagner would be given $1 million plus moving expenses, personal living expenses. In return, America would get the rights for future Wagner works for all time. It is fascinating to think about, because so many Germans did come to America in this period, millions of them restarting their lives, entering into American culture. And who knows what role Wagner could have played. I sort of picture him ending up in California. people always talk about, you know, what if Wagner had lived into the time of early Hollywood, which
I was going to say, he virtually invented the sound of Hollywood epics. I mean,
Hollywood film scoring just doesn't exist without Wagner's example in terms of the use of leitmotifs, in terms of just the way the orchestra sounds on the soundtrack, this big, brash, rich orchestral sound. Just, you know, Wagner is the godfather of Hollywood music, and that's been said many times. And so it is fun to think about, yes, if somehow the Hollywood movie business had begun 20 years earlier, Wagner could have been a part of it.
I'm thinking of a French jazz player I know who said, listening to Wagner for the first time was like listening to Charlie Parker, completely new in rhythm, in chromaticism, in speed, in implication, and God knows the influence is there. But I'm also thinking, how rare are the people who can be described as an adjective? Wagnerian means something, as, say, Stravinskyan doesn't quite, but Shakespearean does work, Homeric does work. How many are there out there, artists whose scope and whose extension is just vastly bigger than we've ever noticed?
Yeah. Well, there are not too many of them. And, you know, the fact that Wagner became an adjective and a noun, Wagnerian and Wagnerism, is a tribute to the really exceptional breadth of that influence. It hasn't happened that often. And you find it everywhere. And you mentioned Charlie Parker. You know, Wagner was so much a part of popular culture early in the 20th century that, you know, these tunes from the Wagner operas, they were as well known as anything in the classical repertory and were kind of quoted alongside, you know, the pop songs of the period. I found some wonderful examples of this. Charlie Parker actually drops a quotation of the song To the Evening Star from Tannhäuser into several of his performances. It was just like a tune that he sort of threw into the mix. Yeah.
He's famous for throwing in Stravinsky.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. With Stravinsky sitting there in the audience, quoting The Rite of Spring. So this is, you know, it's a sign of his versatility, his virtuosity, that you know, he can just sort of work any kind of musical material into his language. There's a kind of horrible Stan Kenton version of The Rite of the Valkyries, which is just really alarming to listen to.
Yeah.
And then absolutely one of the most wonderful things is the not too well-known Stride pianist Donald Lambert did this takeoff on the Tannhäuser Overture that starts kind of rather fairly normal in terms of how he's playing it at the piano. And then halfway through, it suddenly takes off and it goes into this very different world. I sort of classify that under what I call Black Wagnerism, this fascinating sort of little noticed phenomenon of how Wagner proved inspirational to certain African-American writers, artists, and musicians as well.
Alex Strauss, sum it up. All these ambivalences, all these contradictions, all this mixed message, and yet an unbelievably lively organism out there called Wagnerism. We can't really listen without our dukes up, so to speak, but guide us. How should we listen?
You know, I don't have any argument with people who say, I just can't deal with this composer. You know, I respect that. So I'm not really urging people to go out and listen to Wagner and sort of saying this is something that you have to listen to. You know, I respect that resistance. But I do think it's worth at least making an attempt at coming to terms with this composer, because he really was one of the greatest theater artists in cultural history. You know, yes, it's all myth and heroes and legends and swords and spears, but there's always a modern psychology at work, and there's always sort of very rich human themes. Wotan, the all-powerful god who plunges into this abyss of despair after realizing he's doomed. He's doomed to lose his power. You know, that in itself is just one of the most incredible things in opera, that depiction of a powerful man in free fall. It's extraordinarily difficult to do, and Wagner does it in an extraordinary way. So I would say give Wagner a chance in the theater. But of course, we're always going to be wary of him. But, you know, we should always be wary. We should always be wary of art, any kind of art, because it can deceive us. It can be used for bad ends. And so I think this is really the theme that I come back to very strongly at the end of the book. It's always risky to idealize art. And I think when we think about music and literature and the visual arts, we need to get away from this idealization, from this idea that art takes us to a pure, higher, ideal sphere. Because when we let it take us away from reality, then we can become numb to what is surrounding us. And so it can become a force of illusion. It can be used as a weapon. It can be used as a weapon of mass destruction. Of course, we want to be swept away by music. You know, we want to sort of momentarily disappear into a beautiful world. But there can always be a price to pay for that. And with Wagner, no one can ever really have that pure experience again. There's always going to be a shadow lurking.
Alex Strauss, it's such a pleasure to listen to you. You said that writing this book, Wagnerism, has been the great education of your life. Reading it has been a big part of mine. So thank you for the book. Thank you for your work in The New Yorker, too. And thank you for this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. It's been wonderful to talk, and it's such a pleasure to hear that.
Alex Strauss's new book is Wagnerism: Art and Politics in the Shadow of Music. You can support Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series of interviews about storytelling in a time of social distance. This week, he's talking about isolation in Eastern Russia with Jonathan Slatt. Find that conversation at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Mike Garth engineered. Mary McGrath is our Valkyrie. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.